This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 2nd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we have a very British brutalist bonanza. First up, we're in London's Barbican Centre, speaking to an architect who has master-planned a video game set inside its concrete jungle.
To reappropriate those kind of elevated walkways, which were part of this 60s romantic idea of connecting the entirety of London through elevated walkways.
Then accessories designer Ali Capolino gives us a tour of another concrete gem, the Trellick Tower, to find out what brutalism has to do with designing bags.
It's just very powerful looking, and I like big simple things. I try to have big simple bags.
And then we swap concrete brutalism for car bonnets to find out about a new look for Swedish car manufacturer Volvo.
There's a slightly renegade Viking spirit to it. They are really pioneering. I think the last thing the world needs is another highly retouched car hooning down a mountain road.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Now for the first section of the show this week, we have something of a British brutalist theme for our listeners. Both in name and appearance, brutalism has for a long time been off-putting. Many seem to have had a decades-old aversion to the modern, imposingly monolithic, often grey forms of brutalism. Although it certainly doesn't always avoid this kind of criticism, London's Barbican Centre is something of an exception. I can certainly sing the praises of its sleek sculptural properties as I happen to live there, as many of you will know. As the complex becomes more and more on the map of London's architectural icons, one recently graduated student of the London Bartlett School of Architecture has taken his appreciation to a whole new level. He's envisaged a computer game and film using the buildings of the Barbican as direct inspiration.
Fight!
Ed Mascarenhas, welcome to the show. So, first up, tell us about this computer game. Is it sort of an architectural Street Fighter 2 or Tomb Raider?
The main purpose of my project was to understand how augmented reality could be used to reappropriate a site. And so, to do this, I thought a fun way of doing it would be to use a video game. So that was kind of how it became a video game. It was to speculate on how augmented reality can be used to not reintegrate with architecture, but find a new love for it, in a sense, reuse spaces that I find are a bit undervalued. So especially the Barbican, because I absolutely love the Barbican. I think it's a great space. I personally think it's not used enough. Not the Barbican itself, but the surrounding walkways, like Moorfields Walkway and areas like that, like the Pedway, even though that's sadly being a bit redeveloped now. Well, I say sadly, it might turn out to be a nice scheme there, but yes, it was to reappropriate those kind of elevated walkways, which were part of this 60s romantic idea of connecting the entirety of London through elevated walkways.
In terms of video games, so many of them imagined and these sort of worlds we go into and these augmented realities, is it quite sort of a new thing to be doing something from the real world, especially architecturally?
I don't think it's entirely new because there is a field called pervasive games, which are quite popular. There's such games as Google's Ingress, which involves running around real cities with your mobile phone, in a sense. So I don't think it's entirely new, but I do think it's new when coming towards architecture. I feel that it could have a large effect on architecture, and that's why I was speculating on it.
So let's talk about why you chose the Barbican as the setting for this.
I just wanted to re-engage that site, in a sense.
And there's something quite appropriate because it was sort of designed as a kind of utopia, a way of life that doesn't really exist now, that people would one day exist, you know, and live three levels up because cars would be on the ground floor. So I guess it's quite an appropriate thing for this sort of imagined video game.
It also has, I feel, a strong relationship towards the Situationists, who were, like, just like their name explains, they always sought out to make new situations through their architecture. So people like Guy Debord and Constance, they would make up these ways to make new situations, and principally through the act of playing. Constance himself designed a proposal called New Babylon, and it was a massive project that involved elevated walkways itself. So it had there was a strong connection there, and that's another reason why I was led towards the Barbican in a sense.
Tell us a bit more about the game and actually what goes on in it. Is it just sort of walking around and experiencing the architecture? Is there a certain kind of shoot 'em up element to it?
I think the idea of the game is kind of running around hectically, collecting these pieces, and then you place these pieces in the void areas of the Barbican, which are these big spaces, the green spaces, which are in between the walkways. You repopulate those spaces with this augmented layer, and you run around kind of, there's balls that come and try and stop your path, and a bit very like animated landscape.
In the beginning of this week's section, we are talking about brutalism in Britain quite a bit. I mean, the Barbican in particular has sort of come back around everyone's imagination because it seems more popular and more beloved than ever. I'm interested to find out why you particularly loved it and as a setting for a video game. What is it? Well, there's something special about the Barbican above many other brutalist buildings which are still quite despised or have been demolished.
I mean, I find that strange because there's one thing about brutalism is it does photograph well. But when you go there, I love the experience of a lot of brutalist buildings. I don't know if that's because I'm an architecture lover, and I don't know if it's like a biased kind of style. But yeah, there has been a big interest in brutalism recently. I think that might be partly as well due to an increase in publications on brutalism. I think the Jonathan Meads program was quite popular. I've always had a like for brutalism. And the one thing that I like about video games is sci-fi video games, and brutalism and sci-fi go so well together. So that was one of the settings. In the early workings of the games, it was a very sci-fi theme, and it just lent itself to brutalism. That's how I kind of clinged on to it. And also, I just felt that I could, when it comes to the game itself, what you see is you have two packs which the players are fighting with. One pack is kind of this high-tech architecture, and one's a brutalist architecture. So it was about boiling down the architecture into these kind of elements, which was quite a fun aspect of it. And I saw so many elements in brutalism that it came straight away. It was a natural reaction, I think, in a sense as well.
And how long does it take you to develop the game?
The game itself took the best part of 9 months, I would have to say. With the production of the film took maybe 4 to 5 months of that. With the idea was developed all the time, all the way through.
Round one. Fight!
And our journey through the bold beauty of brutalism continues here on Section D as we move from the Barbican and cross London to head for another concrete beacon of this era of modern British architecture. Early neglect led to much criticism and controversy for the Trellick Towers architect, Erno Goldfinger. But now the building is a sought-after address, its remarkable views and sculptural detailing attracting many followers. The tower is also proving to be an inspiration to the world of fashion. Nearby, bag and accessories designer Ali Capolino has looked at the clean lines and muted tones of brutalism when creating her new autumn-winter lookbook. To celebrate this inspiration and to start a dialogue with local customers, Ali organised a brutalist soiree that commenced at her shop on Portobello Road and made its way up to the 18th floor of the Trellick Tower. David Pleasant met Ali and asked her what brutalism has to do with designing bags.
We invited customers, I suppose, to come to hear a talk by the 20th Century Society about Trellick Tower as it's on our manor, and particularly, but brutalism in general.
And your lookbook for the upcoming autumn-winter season, it was inspired by brutalism, brutalist architecture. It's very much part of the photography. Maybe tell us a little bit about the book and your new collection.
I always love buildings. They're photogenic as hell. I mean, particularly modern architecture, I suppose. It's just very powerful looking, and I like big, simple things. I tried to have big, simple bags, and we wanted to have something about us that's more than bags. You know, our customers, we have really interesting customers, and we think we're quite interesting.
I mean, when you talk about maybe for someone who hasn't come across Ali Capolino bags before. What's your kind of design ethic? How does that tie into some? We're looking at the Trellick Tower. It's right in front of us. It's quite an imposing, incredible structure. So it's maybe quite a fitting place to start to talk about your bags.
I always start from the materials, and I think the sort of the concrete evidence of brutalist things. It's very stripped back, I suppose. It's the basics. I really like the basics. I like showing the manufacturer, you know, how things are made so that you can see how things are put together. I really like things which are not pretending to be posh or, you know, I don't know if basic is too basic a word, but I really like simple and stripped back. And I think brutalism is not just that. It's also sort of this sort of imposing kind of glowering thing sometimes, but and I don't necessarily want to sort of scare people with our bags, but...
So you're not trying to make a brutalist bag?
I'm not really trying to make a brutalist bag, but I think, you know, sympathetically, I like the idea of the materials being really quite basic in brutalism and the shapes being quite simple but quite powerful.
It's a great finish, isn't it?
18th floor. Doors opening.
My name's Paul Vonberg. I'm an architect. I'm interested in all things design and architectural, and particularly in the 20th century. And it seemed an opportunity not to miss, really.
Have you been kind of been aware of the Trellick Tower and brutalism, obviously, through architecture schooling and so on?
Well, I was brought up in South London and saw the demolition of acres and acres of good Victorian housing and its replacement by buildings very much like this. And I kind of hate them and love them and think they're the wrong thing to do entirely, but wouldn't have them pulled down, if that makes any sense. So a sort of love-hate, really.
I'm Henrietta Billings, and I'm Senior Conservation Advisor for the 20th Century Society. We were approached by Ali Capolino to do this joint event, really, basically because Ali's autumn winter collection is inspired by brutalist buildings, and a lot of her bags even are photographed with this wonderful kind of brutalist backdrop. This doesn't happen very often, and when the opportunity arose, we jumped at it, basically.
You gave a fantastic, should we just walk on, otherwise we won't miss the flat tour.
Yes,
you gave a fantastic summary of British brutalism, and time again you kind of mentioned how the lack of appreciation or the struggle it has been to really convince people of the value, the heritage value of brutalist architecture. Do you think things are changing a little bit?
Yeah, I actually think they are, and I think we're seeing that through the cases that we deal with, and we're seeing less applications for demolition and really harmful alteration. And we're also, thankfully, seeing more cases of listing of this type of building. A scenario, frankly, that was probably unimaginable 10 years ago. So it's really, it's interesting. I think it's almost a generational change almost. And it's so true that, you know, architecture comes in fashions. It's really quite fickle. And as I said earlier, you know, in the 1960s, Victorian Gothic architecture was the dumps. You know, you couldn't flog it even if you wanted to, you know. It was really deeply unfashionable. So basically what that means is that as architectural fashions change and mature and grow up, we'd say, it's really important that the best examples from those periods are kept for future generations, particularly the ones that people find difficult and jarring now may end up being the ones that we end up really treasuring. And I think Preston bus station is a really good example of that, and the Trellick Tower that we're standing in now. It was conceived at a time when there was this massive optimism and excitement about high-rise, and it was the answer to everyone's problems. It's worth bearing in mind that this site was a Victorian slum in North Kensington. It was notorious. No one had proper loos and bathrooms. It was a very down-at-heel area. The Trellick Tower gave the residents of North Kensington bathrooms and central heating for the first time. It was really important, and it was a very groundbreaking project. The trouble is that almost as soon as it went up, it was already out of fashion. It didn't get the maintenance it needed, and it fell foul of every kind of, you know, architectural fault possible. I think it was blamed for all kinds of things. The architecture itself was blamed for all kinds of things hugely unfairly that now we look back and blame much more on, security. It's the same with a car. If you don't look after your car, it stops working. If you don't look after and invest in these buildings, they need cleaning. The roof needs fixing when it gets wet. They often need, you know, 24-hour levels of some kind of security, whether that's CCTV cameras or things that also help residents feel safe, even if you know, it's a perception thing rather than an actual threat. All these things make a difference to how you appreciate and interact with the building, and blindingly obviously this building didn't get it. And I think the interesting comparison is the Barbican concrete monstrosity, some people might say, and have definitely said over the last few decades. But the difference there was that it's had the commissioner, the designer, the builder,
money basically,
but it's also been one body, it's the local authority, in this case the Corporation of London, and they have a long-term vision. They understand the value of investment and maintenance and management, and that undoubtedly has had a massive impact on why the Barbican works.
English Heritage approved colour matched tiles, there are actually different colours on each floor.
I found that the people who buy from us are really interesting and are good to talk to usually, and they've got lives to live, they've got things to do, and it's not just something to hang on their shoulder. They like the fact that they're functional, and so we've got stuff to talk about, I suppose.
That was David Pleasant speaking to bag designer Ali Capolino at that masterpiece of British brutalism, the Trellick Tower in London's Notting Hill.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Welcome back to Section D. I'm Tom Morris. The architecture of Istanbul is legendary, and for many needs no introduction. From the Hagia Sophia, once Christendom's greatest church, to the Süleymaniye Mosque, a masterpiece of the great Ottoman architect Sinan, the architecture of Istanbul reflects all the influences that have shaped the city. But Istanbul is also a thoroughly modern city, increasingly defined by cutting-edge designs of glass and steel. A new book, co-authored by Murat Gül, a professor of architecture at Tob University of Economics and Technology in Ankara, and Trevor Howells of the University of Sydney, showcases this comprehensive history, keeping the long view while providing readers and would-be urban explorers with a guide to the latest additions of Istanbul's age-old skyline. Monocle contributor Caleb Lauer spoke to co-author Murat Gül in Istanbul.
This book is part of a series published by Australian-based publisher Watermark Architecture Guidebook Series. And they offered me a couple of years back to write a book about Istanbul architecture. I said that's a great idea, because as everybody knows, Istanbul is one of the oldest cities in the world and its architecture is quite diverse and rich. And I also approached my colleague and friend from Sydney University in Australia, Trevor Howells, and I offered him to write the book together. He knows Istanbul and he accepted, and we decided to write the book together. It was a great fun, but also it was a little bit difficult task, because you have some limitations like in every book. We have given 220 entries as the limit. We exceeded it slightly at the end. 226 entries are included in the book, and you have to represent all cities' architecture from the Roman and Byzantine time to contemporary Istanbul. And it was a little bit difficult, because you have to select, you have to be selective. And unfortunately, we have to ignore many important buildings in Istanbul. I wish I could put more entries, more buildings and places in the book, but it wouldn't be possible, of course. The main goal, the main thing we would like to achieve in this book, to represent a very diverse and rich architectural heritage of Istanbul.
One of the things I noticed is that in the chapter, particularly about Levant and Mecidiyeköy, these areas of Istanbul, you've paid quite a bit of attention to the modern buildings that dot the skyline of those neighborhoods. Why was it important to you to include those buildings in a guidebook to Istanbul architecture?
Because we would like to show both successes and shortcomings of city's architecture. Levant and Mecidiyeköy is one of the very important areas in contemporary Istanbul. Mostly started to be developed after 1960s. but mostly after the 70s and became one of the central business districts of the cities with skyscrapers and high-rise buildings. And those buildings are representing what is happening in architectural world, architectural business in Istanbul at the moment, in current day, present day. And there are also some positives and negatives. There are successes when you look at some of those buildings. They are very important, nicely designed, sustainable, contemporary. But when you look at the overall area, you can also see some shortcomings, such as lack of planning, master planning, public domain issues. We don't want to show everything polished. We don't want to say everything is perfect. We try to be as objective as possible, and we try to show what is really happening in contemporary architecture in Istanbul.
And when you say shortcomings, what is causing these shortcomings in terms of the lack of master planning or public domain issues? What is behind that?
As you probably know, Istanbul is growing a lot, especially since the 1950s. And in 1950, the city's population was about a million. And now it's almost 14 million or even 15 million people are living there. In 60 years' time, it means 15 times bigger. And it's a huge population boom. And then when you have that massive influx of people from Anatolia and also business opportunities, sometimes planning are coming behind. You are not able to program everything. And therefore, some of the areas of Istanbul are representing very interesting mixture of high-rise, nicely designed, manicured garden buildings, but at the same time, very poor public domain and infrastructure and lack of planning. One of the examples, interesting, vivid examples of that duality or contrast is definitely in that area, Maslak Mecidiyeköy, Levent.
In a way, your book sort of showcases this tension, which is sometimes creative and sometimes controversial in Turkey, between the old and the new. But that tension between the old and the new is often more complicated than a lot of people realize. What does the architecture of the city and the, you know, going back to the Roman architecture all the way to 21st century architecture, what does it show about that tension that people may not realize?
If you are talking about a city with thousands of years of history, and you can accept that there are different layers and those layers should live together in harmony, for example, the municipal palace in the very center of the city, in the historic peninsula, which was built in the 1950s, early 1950s, and one of the good examples of international style architecture in Turkey after the post-war period, you can see there is a huge contrast between that building, which is very prismatic, very robust, very strong, with the Şehzade Mosque, the 16th century Ottoman mosque. But over time, that sort of contrasts are becoming a part of the heritage of the city, and we should also appreciate that. That contrast should also be included in the city's architectural landscape and morphology.
And one section of the book includes a lot of detailed history and biography of important Istanbul architects themselves. Why did you want to include a section on the actual architects?
Because those are the people who created the architecture of the city since the very early days of the city's history, and we just wanted to represent their life, their biography in a very short and brief manner. We thought that it would be an interesting point for the readers who are interested in architecture, not the building only and the visible spaces, but also people behind those buildings and their lifestyle, their education, their preferences. We just tried to show the people behind this visible architecture, of course.
That was Caleb Lauer with Murat Gül, the co-author of Istanbul Architecture, which is out now. You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where I'm bringing you Section D, our dedicated design show. Still to come today, we'll be getting under the bonnet of new car branding as Volvo unveils its latest model, getting the latest design news from Japan, and having a look around the premises of one of our favourite clothiers. Last week, Volvo unveiled its latest creation to the world. While the Volvo's new SUV carries the same model name as those that came before, Volvo says that the all-new XC90 is a true statement about not only the future of the company, but also the entire car industry. The new XC90 boasts hybrid engine options, collision avoidance systems, and a restyled interior. But beyond that, the car's front end has an updated logo. We use this occasion to take an in-depth look at the business of creating a successful and succinct car brand. First up, our transport editor Trista McAllister caught up with Volvo Senior VP of Marketing, Sales and Customer Service, Alan Visser.
We basically said this is more than just a new car. It's the first car that we developed as an independent company with our own architecture, our own powertrain families, our own design and manufactured design engineered in Sweden by Volvo. It's the first totally decoupled produced car and developed car decoupled from Ford. And it really sets the new standards for Volvo with a new design language. It's almost a symbolic car in the sense that it really starts a new phase, with PH for the Volvo organization. And we said, given the symbolic and quite historic value of that for the company, it probably is not a bad idea to evolve the brand logo as well.
Story seemed to be a big part of the presentation today. You talk about light and Swedish living rooms, and you sort of have these little isms throughout the presentation that sort of lend themselves to this idea of Swedishness. Yeah. How important is Swedishness to the brand, and maybe how important was it to prove that it was important tonight? Because I think for the last 10 or 15 years, maybe, you know, we knew that Volvos were Swedish, but we didn't necessarily hear the story articulated.
You're right, and it's a bit going back to our roots. I think nobody's ever questioned the Swedishness of it, but I think we've never wanted to demonstrate what that means for a consumer, what that means in terms of the product execution. And I think today, the reason why we're also here today is we say we are a brand that is different, that has its own identity. We have chosen to start trying different things as a brand, and the Swedishness being part of the brand, we said, let's not launch this car as everybody else does at a motor show. Let's do it at our home turf in Sweden, where you can not only hear about the brand, but feel the brand. And unfortunately, rain is part of that, which is what you're experiencing today. But it's still an amazingly unique country, and it's part of it. So we wanted to immerse you a bit in what Volvo and Swedishness is all about.
Do you think that part of your challenge in selling the new Volvo is helping people understand that the Chinese buyout isn't really going to change Volvo? It's not going to change the heart of Volvo. I think a lot of people were concerned about that.
Yeah, and I get that question also, not only from the press, from friends a lot, is how does it feel working for a Chinese company? And it is, I think we just can continue to reiterate, we have a very good owner and a solid owner who is very keen on making sure that we stay Volvo and that we act as Volvo, and whose involvement in the operational business is very limited and deliberately chooses to do it that way. So we don't feel in the slightest way a Chinese company. We are 100% Swedish company, and that's also what our owner wants us to be. So I think there's an element of ownership that is not relevant almost in the way the company is run.
That was Monocle's very own transport editor, Trista McAllister, in discussion with Volvo's Senior VP of Marketing, Sales and Customer Service, Alan Visser. We also caught up with Holly Newton, who is the lead designer at Grey London, who are Volvo's global creative agency. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards asked Holly how one begins branding a new car.
There's a latent affection for Volvo. So many people grew up in the back of a Volvo. I grew up in the back of many Volvos. They were trying to identify what it was. There's something solid and brilliant and sturdy and particularly Swedish about that brand. I think the other thing we looked at was Swedish design in general. I think we were looking at that craft and that design and authenticity. There's a very particular simplicity to the work. Like absolute perfection. And I think when you see the new cars coming out, they feel absolutely back to their very best, better than they've ever been. And so we really started to look at that, the difference between textures, colour, material, and really trying to approach our work with the same level of craft and that approach as you would to making a car in many ways.
And is that difficult? Because obviously that some of the words you use, people maybe wouldn't associate them with something that's very cutting edge, you know, automotive industry. Yeah. It's all about CAD-CAM design. It's very advanced. But you're talking about craft and these kind of nuances, these design aesthetics, which people perhaps associate more with cultural output. Yes. rather than automotive output. Is that almost maybe one of the problems perhaps that Volvo has had, is that people have, you know, they've sort of view the brand with that kind of warmth, but it doesn't necessarily compute into cutting edge technologies?
And I think what people will see in the coming year or so is an advance in technology that would be very unexpected. Their new head of design, Thomas Ingleth, is absolutely fabulous. The engineering prowess in that company is phenomenal. I think really, they almost forgot to tell anyone for the last 10 or 20 years. Like, we go to their crash centre, it's ridiculous. It's like stepping into a spaceship. They have all this technology that I never even knew they had. I don't think I've met a more advanced technological company in years. So I think the challenge for us is how you put that out to the world, but not in a cold way, because they're not an Audi or a Lexus. There's something very individual about that brand. I think to try and step away from the sea of same, because it's become such a boring, conventional part of advertising, part of communications, the car industry. So to look at how we address all of those and really get back to their tone of voice and their personality again.
What about that sea of same? Why do you think that happens? People are probably used to a lot of the same sort of motifs. A lot of these things are the same. Is it because, I guess, traditionally it was a field, even within advertising, that was often dominated by men? All the creative directors, the account directors would be. I mean, do you feel that gives you maybe a competitive advantage almost?
Yeah, I think it can. I think really some of it is through just conservatism, which is really boring. And I think as soon as you step into Volvo and you actually step into the company, there's a slightly renegade Viking spirit to it. They are really pioneering. I think the last thing the world needs is another highly retouched car hooning down a mountain road. It just doesn't move
you. There's always a bit of space for that, surely. I mean.
Well, a little bit. But no, it just doesn't move you. I think we just wanted to be able to get a bit of texture and warmth and humanity into the brand.
So is it difficult? I wonder then, when you sort of approach these projects and you see these big companies, you know, if they're in heavy industries or automotive, do you think it's a fundamental problem that people are maybe a bit more cynical or sceptical about big companies and about their messages, and they think they're being spoken to by this big machine of, you know, PR and sort of corporate identity? Is it in some ways easier to be really creative in creative work for maybe smaller and medium-sized brands, perhaps?
I think it definitely can be. I think the main thing is the leadership in that company has to take a deep breath and decide to be really brave, which they have. It's a delight to find a client like that. I think in many ways, because of Volvo's size, they are actually a boutique car brand, which is a fabulous way to look at it. And when we looked at how we might approach the work for Volvo, we looked at other brands, Acne, for instance. We even looked at Céline from France, those smaller brands that are making such an impact on the global stage and in the luxury market.
And what are we to expect then? Obviously, these are going to be some pretty extensive kind of campaigns rolling out over a fairly significant period of time. Will there be these sorts of strands? You talked about the overarching kind of aesthetics and stuff at the beginning. Will we be able to sort of clearly identify those strands, or will we be sort of pushed and pulled in different directions as time passes?
I think that you'll begin to see a new aesthetic, far more confident. It will feel more Swedish, even if we don't shout about being Swedish. I think you'll also start to see an opinion, a point of view from the brand. When we do film, when we use print, it won't just be, you know, that bland retouched car sat on a page or going down the road. There'll be more to it, and it'll have that warmth and that interesting Swedish mindset to it. But also, we're very keen to challenge those conventions. So there's experiences, both physical and digital, interesting, immersive things. I think really the objective is that anytime you come across the brand, it feels very different.
What about then how reactive or confident you'll be about sticking to your guns? Do you expect to change and adapt as you see consumer-led responses? Or, I mean, you've talked already about the clarity of your vision and the client vision, which is, of course, fundamental to this. Do you feel that there's such a clear message that it won't need to sort of react because it'll be doing exactly what it says on the tin?
I think so. We have a campaign coming up that's almost like a prologue or a teaser, followed by the new work for the new car. Hopefully, as we go forwards, people will see a confidence and a different stance from Volvo. It's important that it welcomes you in. It shouldn't feel austere and sort of strange and mechanical. But I think we'd be fools if we didn't adapt and change as we go forwards. We've got a starting point.
And what about across markets, particularly the XC90, which is one of the keys of this whole new push? Very popular in a number of different markets, sell a lot of units in the United States and around the world, this kind of thing. How flexible do you think the kind of creative strategy has to be? Or again, can these messages, if they're made with enough conviction, speak to an audience as much in North America as in South America or in Asia or wherever it might happen to be?
It's funny you should say it. So we've just come back from filming our big XC90 work. I just literally just came off a plane. It's a real challenge, but I think the important thing is to try and find, rather than a market or a target market, is a human insight. That's all you can really do, because humans are pretty similar across the world at their basic level. What we look at is something that aesthetically works really well, and we have a broad theme that we'll put into the work, and then we maybe do slightly different endings on them, or you might have a scene here or there that's slightly different to just reflect what that market needs. Trying to cover something that hits US, France, China and Russia is actually quite a big task. But I think that is what we're aiming to do, work that will work universally, still be interesting. It's very easy to do bland work when you're answering all of that, and then also make people feel something.
So apart from seeing some new and exciting models over the next sort of few months and years, what do you hope that people will come to take away from this? What will they learn? What will they understand about what Volvo means then in, say, 12 months or 18 months time? What do you hope that your creative work will have communicated to Volvo's potential drivers around the world?
I think in lots of the world, it's to remind them that Volvo exists and then to immediately reappraise it. You know, everyone always goes on about it being boxy. It really couldn't be further from the truth. I think when you see the new XC90 and the models coming up, they're really beautiful. So just from seeing that, you'll see what an enormous change there is. But I think also through a lot of the work we'll be doing, the sheer innovative sort of mad inventor spirit that's at the heart of Volvo. There is so much in that company to bring out. It's almost filtering what we talk about first.
That was Monocle's Tom Edwards speaking to lead creator for Grey London's new Volvo project, Holly Newton. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. And now for our regional roundup of the hot design topics making waves around the world, we're heading to Tokyo to talk manhole covers and Frank Lloyd Wright-housed trade fairs. To do so, I'm joined by our bureau chief, Fiona Wilson. Hi, Fiona.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Let's start with Verstockist, which is probably one of the world's most special trade fairs, isn't it? Or at least its location.
I think it's probably my favourite. I have to say, it's not that big. It's about 100 different people showing their work there in Tokyo. It's been going for a few years now, and I go every year. And it's almost like a meeting of old friends, because the same people tend to show every year. And for a start, it's in a really fantastic location. It's in Jiugakuin Girls' School, which is near Ikebukuro Station, and it was built by Frank Lloyd Wright in the 20s, very nearly demolished, as many things are in Tokyo, but was saved and restored. And it's really such a unique building. So this trade fair is every year held there, and it's got a sort of feeling of, I don't know, it's quite a creative fair as well, because people, you know, who haven't seen each other maybe since the previous year, they get together, and just the kind of people who are showing there, it's not very commercial in a way. It's all the sort of small companies. You've got craftspeople, ceramicists, Tembea making bags, Crate, who do fantastic wooden pieces down in Kyushu. It's a real mixed bag. Saito Wood in Shizuoka. I've probably met most of the people who show there and written about them, probably. But, you know, that's what I like about it. It's a group of very like-minded people, not doing the same thing, but there's a nice, really nice atmosphere.
Japanese trade fairs are a bit different to the ones we have in Europe, which are very commercially driven and you have a lot of buyers and it's very much sort of aimed at that part of the market. Whereas Japanese ones seem to be a bit more cute exhibitions, aren't they, really?
Yeah, I mean, I think business is done at Verstockist, definitely. It's just the presentation is so different. It's almost set out like a sort of church hall, because the building kind of feels like a church hall. It's wooden and small scale. There are huge convention centres in Tokyo. Big site is one where you have these really big trade fairs. Trouble with those trade fairs, I've found, is that the people I'm most interested probably don't show there. It's the commercial end of the market, and it's not that interesting for us at Monocle. But, you know, I do go and have a look. I find it's a bit of a mixed bag. And, you know, it's Tokyo. How many people from abroad are really coming to show things here for a couple of days? So I think, in a way, something like Verstockist is a more concentrated. It's a great show. If you're interested, if you're outside Japan, you're interested in what's going on in design and craft at the moment, I would say that's the show to go to.
Next up, Hiroshi Sugimoto has a big exhibition at the moment, doesn't he?
I've always been interested in him. Hiroshi Sugimoto, a great photographer, obviously, goes without saying. But what's interesting is in recent years, he's just moved into so many different areas. He's kind of taken photography, run with it, and is now moving into architecture, now threatening to do something about cooking as well, apparently, I was just reading. And he's even building his own art museum, which I'm so excited about, in Odawara. It's designed by him. You know, in a way, he's created his ideal space. I mean, he's famous for curating his own exhibitions, and he's very concerned about the spaces. In fact, he wrote a book a few years ago, 2011, I think it was, called Sense of Space in Japanese, which was a sort of critique of art museums, which must have been terrifying for the architects, because he sort of gave them grades on how good is the space for showing artworks. And some people didn't come out of it that well. But I mean, you know, people like Peter Zumthor, he really likes, he likes things to be very simple. And yeah, there's a show by him at the moment in Ginza, Koyanagi, which is his gallery, his commercial gallery, the gallery that represents him. And it's photographs on the beach. It's the photographs that people might have seen of decaying metal on beaches. You know, as always, every simple idea of his turns into something so much more profound when you see it. There's the scale of these things, the quality of the printing, the colours. And they're black and white, they're monochrome. So when I say colours, it's really tones. I'm just so interested in what he's doing, and he's getting involved in a lot more things. You've got this Odawara Museum. He was also involved in House Vision, the project that we covered quite extensively, looking at how are people going to live in the future. And he designed this extraordinary tea room, which was a big draw. It's something he's obviously very interested in. And he did another one for the International Architecture Show at Venice this year. It's still on show if you're interested in going. I think it's on until the end of November. You can still see that rather severe glass box in a very long pool of water. But, you know, it's just so interesting that he's taking these ideas and moving them into all sorts of different disciplines.
And now from the sublime to the ridiculous, manhole covers, which we documented in the July-August issue, didn't we? But yeah. A very sort of Japanese approach to the fairly mundane, sewery parts of street furniture.
I know, it did make me laugh, although obviously nothing to laugh about, very serious business, manhole covers. But it just caught my eye, having, you know, just covered this, as we did in Monocle, that there is this quite unusual, I would say, you know, among the 10 million manhole covers apparently that there are, you know, there are these many sort of artistic creations. And if you can believe this organisation actually exists, it's the Japan Sewage Works Association. They set up a competition inviting students in Osaka to design a manhole cover for Osaka. They called it something in Japanese, like, you know, the future of Osaka. And there were two winning entries, and both with symbols of Osaka, which rather amusingly, if you don't come from Osaka, if you come from Osaka, I'm sure you think this is perfectly normal, but it's the takoyaki, the octopus ball.
The octopus which is ball, of course.
The famous octopus ball. Not one of my top favourite bits of Japanese cuisine, and I love pretty much everything else, but it's big in Osaka, and it's going to be on these manhole covers. Both of the winning entries actually have got takoyaki on them, as well as other things. There's Osaka Castle on one and Osaka Tower. So, you know, it was just quite an interesting idea that to try and do something creative with manhole covers. I think it's a sort of strange craft niche that nobody really knows anything about. Although since we wrote about it, I'm now looking at them all the time. I'm noticing far more. And even the ones that don't intend to be artistic are actually rather beautiful.
And they did this quite a serious story behind it, which was that it's almost done to sort of create a sense of pride in people who work in the sewerage industry, wasn't it? To sort of create a sense of esteem with it.
I know, wasn't that so touching? I mean, as if you needed a sense of self-esteem working in the sewerage industry. I mean, why wouldn't you? You know, it's no worse than many other jobs, but there was a feeling that, you know, taking pride in one's job is so important in Japan. And apparently that's how it started in the 80s with a bureaucrat thinking, I know, I've got just the thing to make these people who work in sewerage proud to be sewage workers. And there began this sort of business of getting municipal governments to chip in for creative manhole covers.
And they've got the octopus balls to do it, as it were. Fiona Wilson, thank you very much for joining us on Section D, as ever.
At Grundig, we carefully craft equipment to help you make the most out of your kitchen, which is why we named our new oven and hob appliance collection, We Care. Our multi-taste oven uses three currents of hot air to cook different dishes simultaneously, with 13 cooking functions to choose from and an LCD display. It's one example of how we strive to perfect our technological innovation so that you can enjoy your home, meal after meal. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
To end this week's Section D, we're going to take another look around some of the beautifully designed workspaces that are featuring in the Monocle Guide to Good Business that we've just published in partnership with Gestalten. To see a successful workplace in action, we chose to send our Guy Lutz to prestigious tie and accessories maker Drake's in London's Islington. The building acts as an office, workshop and showroom, and as we'll hear, all at Drake's works in perfect, buzzing harmony.
I suppose the best place to start would be the fact that we're actually on Haberdasher Street itself. As a haberdasher and as one that makes our own, many of our own accessories, actually to be on Haberdasher Street itself, where this, I suppose, all begun in London, when the Huguenots originally came to London, is somehow very appropriate for us. We're in a location very close to Spitalfields, where a lot of silk was originally woven by the Huguenots when they came to London. Ultimately, a lot of them moved out and up to the Essex-Suffolk borders, and actually we are still working with some of those weavers today. One of them is in their 10th generation of being a family business. Going back, I suppose, to your question about how we work here, for us, I suppose it was very important to have a degree of open plan about the whole space. We make a product, we're very proud of how we make something, and the fact that we do actually make something, and we do make something in London, which is fairly unusual in this day and age. And in a sense, even if we're not working in the factory itself, and we have around about 30 people in the actual factory, but lots of people working in and around the factory, we are very close to the factory. There's windows partitioning the factory and the design studio, for example. And to us, that's very important. I mean, I must go into the factory at least half a dozen times during the day, not least because you can actually go in, look at something, check something, try something. And I think when your design space is removed from the actual manufacturing process, I think there's a disconnect there between the two things. And for us, it's very important to be able to go in and have that connection and to be able to tweak and improve things and try things as we see fit.
And can you tell me a bit more about this open plan? Were these windows here originally? What is this material?
Do you know, they weren't actually here originally, the windows. They're crittle windows that we put in. So they were made just, again, not far away down the road in East London by Crittle. There were actually some rather nasty plastic double glazing that was around the whole building. And I suppose really we wanted to return the building, if we could, to its original state as it would have been in the 1930s when it was originally built. It was added onto in the 60s, and that's when the windows would have been changed. So for us, yeah, it was a huge investment putting beautiful windows back in, but it felt like the right thing to do.
So the whole office seems very connected, but is there any communal space where everyone shares a dining room? Or
definitely. I'll take you over in a second. Over in the corner, we have our canteen. And actually, it's only since we built this space here that everybody can break and eat together at the same time. And to us, that was very important. We had a wonderful factory back in Garrett Street where we were, going back a couple of years now. But we had a very pokey little room where everybody ate. And so that had to be done in shifts so that you could never sit down together, have lunch together, and have a decent break in the middle of the day. Which was wonderful, but it wasn't necessarily conducive to manufacturing a product as smoothly as and as efficiently as one might ideally like to. And so for us coming here, we had the opportunity to actually build a factory with the appropriate flow. So literally, we have a goods yard out the back. The cloth comes up the lift and directly onto our checking tables. So it has to travel the least distance possible from when the cloth has arrived on site. So it doesn't essentially have to come into the building if it's not right. We check it almost as it's coming into the building. And from that point, we're manufacturing with exactly the right flow through the workroom itself. So it goes from checking straight into cutting, joining the three different parts of the tie together, the blade, neck and tail, then into open press, and then slipping, and then pressing. So everything is running in the correct sequence as we would ideally like it for the workshop. And I think that was something that was really paramount to what we wanted to put in place when we moved here. We're actually in the slipping room itself. So slipping is the term made for actually sewing the tie together with one continuous, what we call slip stitch, which is joining one end of the tie with one continuous silk thread, a very strong silk thread. One of the things that we put in was the extra long tables so that when you're slipping, it's a lot more comfortable and you can work with the whole tie in front of you rather than if you're on a small table, you're working with the tie just in the piece of the tie that you're actually joining at any one moment. So we've come over here because this is where we're right next to the goods entrance where the cloth comes in. And this is where the cloth gets rolled out. Alini checks every single meter of the cloth.
So much light here. It's perfect for that.
Absolutely, no. It's we even actually had to put a, believe it or not, another light in above in the middle table here. So we've got three across with plenty of light from behind and light all around the whole building. So straight after checking in process, we're over to cutting. This is Mario, our head cutter, who's been cutting with us for over 20 years. Again, a table that we made expressly for cutting. As you can see, it's a big chunky table where panels of silk are able to be laid up.
Can you tell me a bit about the concept of having the factory, the commercial branch, and the shop all in the same building?
Absolutely. Going back to where we were before, we didn't quite have everything under one roof. We had all our warehousing down in South Bermondsey. So we were manufacturing Clerkenwell, but we had our warehousing down in Bermondsey. It worked for sure, but it's so much more convenient having everything under one roof.
That was Guy Lutz speaking to Michael Hill, director of tie and accessories manufacturer Drake's. And that's all we've got time for on today's Section D. Do join us next week as we'll be coming to you from Paris, which will be hosting the furniture and homeware designers of the world for the Maison et Objet trade fair. I'll be there meeting some of them and giving you Monocle's top tips. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer David at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and playing you out is a tribute to the grey brutalist beauties we heard about at the beginning of the show. Let's have a song by The Concretes, You Can't Hurry Love. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.